The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 372 for January 3rd, 2012. Happy New Year, everybody! Happy New Year, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, you send in your tips, we provide some answers, we provide some tips of our own, and together we all learn a little something new about the Mac and other Apple products. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun, and then back
in another part of Durham, New Hampshire is Pilot Pete.
Slightly different part of Durham, New Hampshire. Same elevation.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
And TMO Towers.
Northeast. TMO Towers East. That's right. Yeah. So it's been, we enjoyed our week off. We enjoyed our festive celebrations and we're back to rock it out and have some fun podcasting. I don't know about you, John, but I've been looking forward to this all day. So shall we get into this? Shall we dive right in here? Or do you have?
Yeah, I was ready to. I was chomping at the bit.
All right, let's chomp.
All these great questions. So chomp away.
All right, Micah writes. He says, "I have a question about my new iPhone 4S. Despite some Googling, I could not find a solution for this. How do I shut off the preview alert on the iPhone for incoming text messages?" So, I did some clarification with Micah here. What he's looking for is he wants to know, you know, when you get a text message on your iPhone. It shows you the message on the lock screen and
it could be bad.
That could be right. Yeah, exactly. So, look, everybody has their own reasons. But you can, especially with iOS 5, you can do all sorts of things. So you're going to start by going to settings, notifications, and then in the notification center list, you will likely find something called messages. It's probably right up near the top. So there are numerous options here. Three from the bottom is show preview. That will cause the phone to show simply text message and the name of the person who sent it to you, but none of the actual text of the message on the lock screen and in the notification center, which is the little thing that floats down from the top. Alternatively, or, you know, perhaps additionally, if you don't want it to appear at all on your lock screen, you can disable the view in lock screen option, which is two down from the show preview. And then all you hear is the sound or vibration, depending on how you have things set, but you won't see it appear on your lock screen. The icon will still be badged. Your messages icon will still be badged. But of course, you can disable that too with the badge app icon slider, and you can turn that off. Okay, so there's one last thing, though. If you don't want any sound at all when it comes in, you can go to Settings, Sounds, and then change Text Tone to None. And then you'll never even know. If you do all this stuff, you'll never even know you have a text message. And you can remove it from the Notification Center, too, there's two ways to do that. One is to just simply... if you go back into Settings, Notification, Messages, you can slide the Notification Center slider off. The other thing you can do is if you go to Settings, Notifications, you can hit Edit and you can change the order of things as they will appear in the Notification Center. And you can slide it all the way down and get it out of the Notification Center. And I'm going to confirm that this works. Yep, sure enough, it works. So you can take it right out of the Notification Center that way. So this is, of course... obviously we were answering Micah's question here about, the messages app, text messages, but, all of this stuff applies to pretty much anything that appears in the notification center. So you can use this to your advantage with just about any app that provides notifications. So pretty cool stuff. This is one of the things about iOS 5 that's very cool that you can,
it's nice. It's almost like being jailbroken with this notification center.
It really is.
You know, that's a nice improvement.
It definitely is. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you play around with this, John? Notification Center?
You know, I think I stumbled across it one day. I had not. You know, this is a tip that I don't think I've shared. We'll find it. But no, I just one day, once I upgraded to iOS 5 after, you know, everybody was dogpiling on Apple, just one day, I hadn't yet read the manual or really been paying attention when they were talking about all the new features. And I just, out of curiosity or accidentally, I swiped from the top to the bottom on my iPhone. And all of a sudden, I got this really cool, you know, it's the weather and my calendar. And there's a stock ticker. And then notifications from the various applications, you know, and I got like Instagram and Dataman and a few others here. So the answer is yes. Now you actually just helped me find something, Dave, that's been bugging me for a while is when good. I do get SMSs. And I just found where it is.
The option I didn't mention, but it could be the favorite option of all. So go ahead. Yes.
Well, here's the one that has always been bugging me. So when I get an SMS and I have the, I think the glass sound.
Okay.
So under notifications, messages, I just noticed this setting and I just changed it. Repeat alert.
Yes.
Well, what would always happen is I'd get an SMS and then I thought it was being sent twice because it would make a noise. And then a few minutes later, it would make the same noise. And I'm like, well, why are you either somebody sending the message twice, which is at first what I thought, but then I only see one message. So apparently the default setting is maybe because it figures you may not always be near your phone.
You didn't hear it the first time.
So I changed it to repeat alert never. So now I can, because I just found it kind of annoying.
That is annoying. Yeah. Yeah. And that was something that was not there in the initial version of iOS, whatever.
And what?
It sucked.
It's better once, twice, three, five, or 10 times. Why would you
just keep bugging me with it?
Yeah. Just keep. That's right.
Well, I don't, you know, if someone works in a noisy environment or something or knows
that could be. Out, yeah. You know, yeah.
To each his own. But
maybe,
you know, it saved me a couple of times. I've gotten it. And it's like,
okay. Before,
so I leave mine on twice.
You do, huh?
I do.
Okay.
I do. If I don't get to it, you know, and I hear something and I'm making lunch for the kids or something like that.
Yep.
And then I forget about it. And then it dings, you know, 90 seconds, 2 minutes later, whatever it is. Just, oh, yeah. Let me go look at that.
Right.
So, but if you look at it, then you don't get the second notification. It doesn't ding a second time. If you look at it right away, you swipe, and look at it, then you're good to go. But if you just leave it and look at it on the lock screen, and then you turn this off, you'll get that message. You won't get the message on your lock screen. As per the tip.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Right. Cool. That's cool. Yeah. It's nice to be able to customize. That's what we all want. That's, for the most part, that's what jailbreaking has been about.
That's what I feel, like to customize.
Yeah. All right. And speaking of jailbreaking, for those of you that didn't know, iOS 5.01 on everything except the iPhone 4S and the iPad 2 is now available with an untethered jailbreak. It's through Red Snow, and we had an article at TML this week or last week.
Like it.
Yeah. Yeah. I did it with all Lisa's stuff. I can't do it with any of mine.
In fact, there was someone posted in the forums saying, why do you use it? And I answered that with about a half a dozen reasons. I still jailbreak.
Yeah. No, it's good. It's good. Well, name one of them while we're here.
The main one is customization, but my favorite is using my 3G, which kind of lies to the phone and says, yeah, don't worry about it. You're on Wi-Fi and it doesn't adhere to the 10 megabyte download limit that AT&T sets on my phone.
Got it. Yeah, that's handy. All right. Okay, let's go to Adam here. Adam writes, hey guys, I've been having trouble with the top sites feature in Safari 5. When the top sites opens, I do not see thumbnails of the sites. All I can see is the Safari logo. If I move my cursor over the thumbnails, I'll be able to see the website address, but I can't see a preview of the site. Any thoughts, John?
Absolutely. So, one, you may be asking yourself, what is this top sites thing that we're talking about here?
And it's that annoying thing that opens in Safari, Snow Leopard, right?
Well, it may. You can disable it, I think. But
it's
also
the default,
it will,
right? Yeah, it is.
Sounds like he disabled it.
Yeah, it is the default. But most of us probably disabled it so long ago.
Yeah. Because I haven't seen it in ages. But if you do want to see it again, if you look in the towards the top of your Safari menu, you're going to see a little bunch of dots, and that will show the top sites. It also, and then there's a tab at the top. You can also show your history as well. But it sounds like what he's having is issues.
Talk to me about this.
All right. So you see the top of the Safari window.
Where it has like my red, green, yellow.
All right. And then you go down a little bit, you see like a set of glasses, you'll see a little book, and then you'll see a bunch of dots.
Oh, I don't see the dots. I think I've turned that off. So you have to turn that back on.
That's your tab bar. What's it called? Bookmark bar.
Yeah. So yeah. Safari.
You need to view bookmark
preferences. Hang on. It's there. Yes.
Well, that's on my Snow Leopard machine. I see it.
Bar.
Right. Safari preferences, bookmarks. And then in bookmarks bar, I can turn on include top sites. And now I see a checkbox. Because I hated it so much. I turned it all off, apparently.
Okay. Because actually, so I think I have it on Safari on my Snow Leopard machine, but off.
Okay.
All right. So, all right. But that's a good tip for people if you want to see it or not see it.
Yeah.
So, but here's the thing. I would think sometimes, you know, a lot of the stuff, I guess, is cached or stored somewhere. And I don't know if it really matters where. But it sounds like some of that data is stale or corrupted or something's wrong with it.
So I'm actually seeing what Adam describes, but only on about half of my top sites. Half of them are showing, you know, a thumbnail of what the site looked like. And then the other half are just showing.
I've got this similar. I've only got one of my windows is like that.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's just out of cache or something.
Well, I loaded it and then I came back and I have the same problem. So what's the solution, John? Help solve this for us.
Well, I think this is going to be a solution for a lot of problems with Safari.
Okay. And
what you want to do is you want to go to
Safari. Don't say use Firefox.
Right.
You certainly could. You know, I got to be honest. Firefox is my backup browser. If something's not working in Safari, Firefox is my second choice. And between the two, it's got to work. But if you go to the Safari menu, you're going to see reset Safari ... All right. Well, let's pick that. And then if you look there, you're going to get a whole bunch of checkboxes. And as far as I can tell, it's identical or pretty much identical between Snow Leopard and Lion. And what I would recommend is he may want to, now it's going to get rid of your data, but you probably want to do this. But I see two choices here that I think either one or the other or both will fix the problem. And one is reset top sites. Okay. And then the other, I think, has something to do with it, because it sounds like this may be corrupted, is remove all web page preview images. And it sounds like those images may be kind of messed up. So
I tried
that was
the
my
latter,
suggestion.
I tried the latter first, and that now I have the screen that Adam describes where all of them are just the Safari logos.
Now, if you go to TMO or something like that, you should be able to then go back to
top exactly. Site. So I'm going to TMO, and I'm going to let the site load in full, and now I'm going back.
There it is.
So yeah, that fixed it. Now I had one for whatever reason. I was on the spec product site, probably because we were talking about it during the last show, and that one would not come up with a with a thumbnail, and it still doesn't.
Look at that.
Very interesting.
Some images just aren't caching for some reason.
Yep.
Now, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because you may be asking yourself, is there any way for me to empty the various caches in Safari?
Right.
And well, that menu is right next to Reset Safari. And there's another one, which I think is a bit more comprehensive. And it says empty cache, ... also in the Safari menu. And I think that empties all caches.
That one's
a bit more severe. So, well, try that one, Dave.
I am. It's not
going to hurt. I don't think it hurts anything. It just, you know, it'll slow things down for a bit because it. Did that fix it?
No, it didn't. But, you know, I wonder if this has something to do with how the CSS for these sites are built.
Oh yeah.
You know, because let me see. Cause I'm going back
to Yahoo or something.
Yeah.
Like that, cause Yahoo, I think loads.
Yeah. These all come up just fine. So I think it's, I think it has to do with just how some of these sites are built.
I think I'm with you on that. Cause you know, I've also noticed the same thing, Dave, sometimes especially when I try to print a web page. I see in the print preview isn't always what I see in Safari. Sometimes it's a subset.
Right. Well, you can actually, believe it or not, you can set a media type. I believe it's a media type. I'm a CSS guy. I am not. But so I might get terminology wrong, but I'll get the general concept right. And that is that when you're building your page, you set a style sheet, or in these days, usually multiple style sheets, that define how certain elements look when they're displayed on the screen. But you can also create a style sheet for printing. So those same elements might be formatted differently or might not appear at all when being printed. So that's why some web pages look radically different when you print them versus when you see them on the screen. So there you go. However, I do have, we're all over the place today, but we got good tips. So have you ever wanted to print a web page, but, or take a screenshot of a web page, but your screen isn't tall enough to take the full shot? And so you don't, you know, you could take a screenshot of one part and then scroll and then take a screenshot of the other part and then try and like put them together inside like, you know, Acorn or Pixelmator or Graphic Converter or whatever. And, you know, that would work, but it's a big pain in the neck. So enter Sketch to the rescue. And I've got to find the right option. Obviously, I wasn't prepared at all for this. You don't have Sketch on your computer, do you, Pete?
I don't.
Okay. So hang on. I have Sketch on the computer downstairs. So remote access to the rescue. There is an option with Sketch to go and grab the current window of Safari and simply have it go right into the deal. So if you launch Sketch and go to the little gear. So Sketch is this cool little screenshot app. I'll rewind a little bit. Sketch.com. It's now owned by Evernote. It is free. It's awesome. It allows you to mark up your screenshots. You can do things with them. You can put little arrows on them and diagrams and circles and arrows on the back of each one, except you have to put them on the front because there is no back to a screenshot. But once you've got Sketch like running and opened up, you will see a little in the upper left hand corner right next to the minimize button. You'll see a little gear or tool icon. And if you go there, you will find. Oh, come on. Yeah, there it is. Where's the Safari thing? Oh, I know it was there. Dang it, John. What's the magic here? I know. Snap Safari. There it is. So it's about 2/3 of the way down. And if you choose Snap Safari, what it does is it goes and gets that web page in the view that you would get in your web browser and gives you a big, huge, long, scrollable because it's on your screen, but it's one image of the entire page.
That's cool.
Which is really handy if you're doing stuff where you need more, if you plan on displaying more than you could actually hold on your screen at any moment.
Yeah, will that span across pages or does it just compress it all down?
It's just one big, huge image.
Okay.
Yep.
Oh.
Yep.
Huh.
Yep.
Usually what I do is I just go to print and I just use that scaling factor until it fits on one page.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, which that would
you
work.
The risk there is that you could get something that's, you know, in fly spec 3 font and you can't read it.
Fly spec 3. I love it. That's awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, John F. Braun. He'll be here all week.
I've just always heard the very small fonts referred to as. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, but that's where preview when it does show you what you expect.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, being all over the place, but the other thing I like doing is when you're on a web page, save as and save it as a web archive, which is one of the formats. And you know, actually, that seems to, you know, I was doing some cross-platform work, and I, as far as I can tell, I'm pretty sure that's cross-platform. When you save something out as a web archive, so if you go to File, Save As, and Web Archive.
In Safari, yeah.
Yeah, because I recall doing this on bringing that file over to a Windows machine, and when I opened it, it seemed to open okay in IE. It looked the same, at least for pages that are fairly static. All right, what's next?
All right, let's see. All right, let's go to Irv. As they all are, this is yet another good one. Irv writes. MobileMe allowed large email attachments to be uploaded to the MobileMe server and then an email created in MobileMe to one or more people with a link to allow the zip of whatever file I uploaded to be downloaded. With the advent of iCloud, this service has gone away or will go away next June. What alternative service do you recommend or do you think iCloud will be upgraded to handle this useful task? Okay. Let's not wait for iCal, right? iCloud, rather, to do this. So John, what would you do to solve this problem?
I'm going to recommend a service. I've been using these guys for ages. I don't remember when they came out, but it revolved around the concept that sending files through email is not the best thing, because email really was not meant to send files.
Right.
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 And they do all sorts of weird things to get around it, is that, you know, you have to do bin hex or whatever. You have to translate it to first. Yeah. So one is you got to translate it into a format where binary data can be represented properly, because email or some systems really are only meant to send text and not binary data, or they may screw it up. And then, as I think you were suggesting, Pete, a lot of systems, the payload is not going to be, a lot of email systems will limit the size of a single message. And when you're trying to send a file, it doesn't know that it's a file. It just knows, hey, you're trying to send 10 megabytes, man. What's wrong? What are you, nuts?
Yeah, right.
And it's going to cut you off. It may not send, or it may, barf a message at you saying, what are you doing? Or it may just fail. So what I think is very clever, and I think these are one of the first people that did this, is YouSendIt. So what they did is they combined email and a web browser. Because the nice thing about a web browser is a web browser, HTTP, can upload and download files with no size restrictions. And so what they have, and they still have a free plan here, though they're reducing the capability. So, and I still have an account here. So they have something called YouSendIt Lite. What it allows you to do is send a file up to a maximum of 50 megabytes. Which for free, that's okay.
Yeah.
And then what happens is it stores the file for a certain amount of time on their servers. And then what happens is you send an email, and then when the people get the email, they go to the YouSendIt server and download the file using their browser. And that's a good way to do it. And also the maximum is 2 gigabytes. So I guess it, sits on their server for a while. So you can't do a lot. And then they have various plans here. They got a pro plan that's $10 a month. And that gives you both more storage and greater file size, and also gives you, confirmation and,
yeah.
HTTPS, I think they had, more security. And so that's that whole concept. Now, YouSendIt is the only one I know. If anybody knows of any, I know there are similar services that aren't YouSendIt.
Well, there's actually quite a few. And I want to point out, John,
that use the browser as the mechanism for uploading and downloading the files. Okay.
Yep. So, but importantly, I want to make sure people understand that they are going to YouSendIt.com, because that version of YouSendIt is what John's talking about here. If you go to the letter U, SENDIT.com, it will simply redirect you to IBM.com's homepage. So clearly they're sitting on a domain for potentially a future service. Yeah. So make sure you go to YOUSendIt.com. And that works. There are a couple of others. Drop Send is one. You can do it up to 2 gigabytes. They have different levels of you get to send 5 per month for their free version, but you can send 2 gigabyte files through DropSend. So that's worth checking out. MediaFire lets you use, let's look at their pricing here. It's a similar thing. And I think, they're not going to tell me how big it is. They say you can upload as much as you want. So there you go. That's what they're saying. They're not being entirely clear. Okay, here we go. So So MediaFire is up to 200 megabytes for free. And then for $10 a month, you get 4 gigs, and $50 a month, you get 10 gigs per file. So there you go. So that's MediaFire. And then SendSpace is yet another one. Who requires a sign up, but I believe they are, you can send for free if you don't mind seeing ads, is how it seems to work. Mm-hmm. So that's SendSpace. And lastly, transferbigfiles.com. So yet another one of these where you get 100 megs worth. Transfer Big Files is interesting because you can keep adding files to it and then just send them all at once. So I'd check out DropSend YouSendIt is the one, obviously, we use it here. I use it to send the AAC file to Michael Johnston each time around. And it's been working well for us for what, 6 years now. But if you want something a little bigger, I'd check out DropSend.
Oh, okay. Right. Because, yeah, I came up with most of the ones you mentioned. I just did a Google for HTTP file transfer service.
Uh-huh.
And most of the ones you mentioned came up. So that's one option. And I guess the other option is you have all these cloud services. You know, of course, our one of the first and foremost, and I think our favorite is Dropbox. And they allow you to, I don't think they allow you to do a public to send a public link. And I think it's accomplishing pretty much the same thing.
That's right.
Or yeah, so you put a file in Dropbox and then you got a link. Oh, right. OK, you can do that, too. So that's another option is rather than these browser based solutions is to use one of these cloud file services that I think almost all of them will offer a way to create a browser link to a file in the cloud. And, you know, of course, there's Dropbox, SugarSync, I think Box.com and Pogo Plug are the four that come to my mind that I think are the four of the most popular.
Box.net, isn't it?
They're not Box.com.
Oh, okay.
Oh, are they really?
Well, uh-huh. Try to go to Box.net and see what happens.
I'm afraid to.
Don't be afraid. I wouldn't lead you wrong, okay. Pete.
Just saying.
No, I got an announcement the other day. They're like, we've changed from box.net to box.com. I'm like,
that's cool.
Okay. I kind of like the .net. But yeah, so they just redirect, but it's the same. And all these
when,
services.
When Dropbox started, they did not have dropbox.com. They were getdropbox.com.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Our first sponsor for this show is Smile Software. At smilesoftware.com. And I love when we get to talk about this one. It's Text Expander time. Text Expander is this awesome utility that I can't imagine living without. The concept behind Text Expander is really simple. You have all these little things that you type all the time. Maybe your address, maybe an email signature, maybe a sign off. Maybe you've got some semi-form letter that you wind up typing a lot or some text that you wind up using all the time at work or at home. Well, the idea is you type it once and either type it into Text Expander or type it in your favorite app and then paste it into Text Expander and give it a shortcut, give it a snippet. So if you've got like, I've used this example before, but you know, I have my address and I have John's address both in Text Expander, so I don't have to retype them, nor do I have to think about them. And for John, I type comma JBADD and bam, his address comes out fully formatted, carriage returns, everything good to go. I don't have to think about it. I know I've got it right. And I didn't have to go anywhere to look it up. Same with mine. I've got comma DHADD and boom, out comes my address. I've got it with my signatures for email. I've got it with sign offs. I've got it with all kinds of different. I have my phone numbers in there. If you trust yourself, I guess you could put your credit card numbers in there. Your mileage may vary. You might wind up shopping too much. And maybe that's a good thing. Help spur the economy. Buy Text Expander, put your credit card in, and buy everything else. There you go.
I even use it for forms and stuff. I have like comma F for my first name, comma L for my last name, comma ST puts in my street, comma Z. Those are my abbreviations.
There you go.
The zip, so I can bang right through for my phone numbers, all that kind of stuff. And I've saved over 4.5 hours and 77,000 typing characters with my Text Expander.
That's outstanding.
I love it.
So check it out, smilesoftware.com. Of course, you can download a free trial. And then when you're ready to buy, it's $35. Actually, you save a nickel. It's $34.95 and you buy it right there. Text Expander Touch is also available for your iOS devices. Now, you've got to use apps that have Text Expander Touch support built in to get the full experience. But you can go in and type an email or an SMS inside Text Expander Touch and then have it sent out from there, too. And you can check that out on the App Store for $4.99. So check them all out. SmileSoftware.com and Text Expander and Text Expander Touch. Two really useful. And it's Text Expander is like one of the first five apps I put on my Mac or any Mac that I'm setting up for me. So I recommend you check it out. Text Expander, smilesoftware.com. All right, John. So I did something interesting over the holidays that kind of matches up with Michael's question here. And that is I turned on iTunes Match again. And I've had some interesting things with it. And we're going to talk about Michael's interesting things. In fact, we'll talk about Michael's first. He writes, I have a couple of iTunes match issues that are puzzling me. So far, I've uploaded about 300 tracks, taking my time to do what I can before actually uploading in order to correctly identify artists and albums. In the process, I usually bounce the tracks against Music Brain's Picard and or research on Google and Amazon to run down correct info and artwork. I have maybe 7,000 more tracks to go, so I'm really interested in determining what I may be doing wrong early on. Most of my music is a mix of big band swing, singers and standards from the early 40s, 50s, and 60s, folk music from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and a mixed bag of light rock up to current day. Along the way, some classical and new age. Usually by the time I'm ready to move the tracks out of my working folder and into the iTunes automatically add to the library folder, I have artwork for all the tracks and at least title, artist, album, and genre. iTunes does its thing pretty quickly, and voila, there they are in iTunes Matches library. One thing is, sometimes the artwork disappears for uploaded tracks. I've gone so far as to go into iTunes and reapply the artwork directly. Sometimes that works, but once in a while, other tracks in the cloud seem to disassociate from their artwork. I've seen no rhyme or reason. After a while, I changed the procedure and waited until iTunes imported new tracks, and then and only then did I apply the artwork. The occasional disappearing act persists. The second issue is iTunes almost never finds a match for my tracks, even after going through the effort to correct the metadata and attach album artwork. I would guesstimate maybe 90% of my music is simply uploaded because iTunes Match doesn't know what it is. Now I can understand why it may burp on that live air check of the Artie Shaw Band from 1939, but it can't identify and find studio tracks from Emmylou Harris or Willie Nelson or Neil Young. That seems odd to me. Okay. And he says, how come iTunes Match can't find these, but other things can't? So it sounds like, so iTunes Match, the concept here is it takes a look at what you have and then compares that against what they have in their cloud servers. And if the match isn't there, then it uploads it. So you can still have access to your music. The way it does this matching is a couple of different things altogether. It looks at your ID3 tags, which are your the data that you've added in, the metadata, the title, the artist name, the album name, maybe the year, maybe the genre. And then it also looks at it does a wave sample, like a waveform sample of your file, and sort of compares that against. But I think it starts with the ID3 stuff. So if that stuff isn't right or is in sort of a weird format, it's not going to work. I would recommend using something called TuneUp at tuneupmedia.com. I know a lot of people have thrown their iTunes libraries against this and had it match up everything prior to going to iTunes Match, and it's worked out really, really well. So that would be the first thing I would try for you there, Michael. And hopefully it's going to find more than just 10% of your music. I found, I guess it found about 60 to 70% of what I have, but I've got a lot of, you know, live stuff that hasn't ever been really released and that sort of thing. So that seemed about right for me, but yeah, 10% seems low. Have either one of you guys played with iTunes Match, or am I on my own?
No.
Okay.
I'd be interested in them.
Yeah. So it's actually been pretty good. Now there is a trick, because one of the things that's frustrating about iTunes Match is that once you do this on your computer, then of course you go and enable iTunes Match on your iOS devices. Once you've done that, there is no more syncing of music between your computer and your iOS devices directly via USB like you're used to. But the way you get music onto these devices is you just go into your music library and you'll see everything that's out there, including the stuff that's not on your device. And you can actually turn that off, whether you want to see the extra stuff or not. But you can then say, OK, that's out in the cloud. I just want to download it, and it'll download it. But it's sort of frustrating that you've now got to download these tracks over, you know, your Wi-Fi bandwidth or your 3G bandwidth onto your device. But it works. There is a trick, though. If you know that there's music you're going to want out there, before you enable iTunes Match on your iOS device, do a sync and copy the music. And then when you enable iTunes Match, the music that was on there stays on there. It will take a little while. If you turn on iTunes Match and immediately run to the music app, things are going to look funky for a little while, because you're going to kind of see it in its transition phase. So give it about an hour, and then it usually is fine. However, I have found a couple of songs, and I don't know why this is, but I found songs that I synced over previously. They're in the cloud. I can play them from the cloud. However, they will not play on the device that they were synced to initially until I delete them and make it re-download them. And to delete, this is it's what you would expect, and it does not delete from the cloud. It only deletes from the device. You just swipe across like you would a mail message or something like that. The little delete button shows up, hit delete. The song will stay there. And then it turns into it's got a little cloud icon that you can hit to start the download again. And then you're good to go. So that's the trick I've found out. For the most part, it's been working okay, much better than my initial attempt with it. But, I've had it for less than a week. So, and I haven't really been out and traveling with it. So I haven't gotten the full benefit of being able to, you know, sync without syncing kind of thing. But you know, I like it this time around. So you going to check it out, John, or no?
I don't know. You know, I dove into the iCloud migration and probably shouldn't. So I think I'm going to.
You're waiting on this, huh?
Oh, the thing is, right now, my music life is simple. I have my library on my Mini on yep. iTunes, and I have an iPod Touch, and pretty much all my music fits on there. And I really, I'm okay with that setup. I don't really have a burning desire to have all my music in the cloud and being able to listen to it anywhere. So,
yeah,
pretty much the only time I rock out is, you know, with my A5s at home.
Well, there you go.
Or playing the radio in the car. You know, you've heard of these things, AM, FM radio.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they still make those.
Well, when I bought my car, they did.
That's awesome.
And it's still got a cassette deck. Get that. Yeah, I did. You know, I still, that they do still make those. I do want to, I think they're still out there. I don't think they're actively being made or not in high quantities, but they still have the iPod, because my stereo was, you know, the basic model, and it doesn't have a line in or anything in, but I still think they make these converters that will output the data to a cassette interface, and then you can play your iPod.
They do
that.
Yeah, they definitely do. Yeah. All right, how are we doing on time here? Let's see, we're 36. Yeah, okay, let's go to Dave and let's see what Dave has to say.
Dave's not here, man.
Hello guys, Dave Cook here. Start. Try to be quick. I have a question and looking for some advice. I had a little bit of a disaster last week. I'm an audio engineer, and I was doing some remote recording with my Purple Rig. And I have been using, for my remote stuff, I've been using the C rugged drives, the little orange guys. And I had a 500 gig FireWire drive. But this particular drive I've had for probably about 4 months and been great, no problem. And I was using that to track, and I went to go back up the next day, back up the session, and it's just this big old, I forget what it is, I think it's the Western Digital, it's just you know, relatively inexpensive. I'll drop about a gig and a half. And then I also have another one of those that I do a carbon copy cloner to. So I'm kind of a backup freak, and everything's very safe. So anyway, but with this, I was in the midst of a backup, and I don't know, I can't tell you exactly what happened, but I know that I was kind of moving some things around at my work area where I was set up, and I must have hit a power cord or a FireWire cord, because when I looked, I had the dreaded, you know, device was unmounted properly or whatever that message is, which you see a lot when you unplug before unmounting. And generally, I haven't lost any data when that's happened. So I went to go see what was going on and try to finish the backup. The backup was about 3/4 finished. I got spinning beach balls and nothing was really happening. So I waited a couple minutes, still nothing was happening. So I couldn't even shut down. So I did a hard shutdown by holding the power button on my laptop, my MacBook Pro. Okay. So then when everything came back up again, the listee came up with the other dreaded window saying, it can't be read. Would you like to initialize? So I went to shriek mode. Luckily, what I lost was the rehearsal and an alternate day of recording, alternate takes from the actual shows that I was tracking, but still not good.
All right. So he goes on to say that he tried Disc Warrior that failed. And then ask, of course, what are the other options? So, yeah, in case it wasn't clear, he lost the drive that he was backing up from. They were both external drives. And it is odd. It is rare, rather, I should say, that pulling the power from a drive during a read operation, which is what he was going through, would cause this kind of damage. But it is possible. It is not odd. It is simply rare. So this can happen, and it is a risk that, you know, backing up a drive actually puts it in a state where it is, you know, subject to having some file system corruption. Now, it's important to note Disk Warrior is a fantastic utility. It would be my first line of defense for something like this. But what it does is it completely recreates the directory structure on the drive based on what it finds on the disk. I've explained this before, but for the benefit of perhaps new listeners and really all of us out there, the data on your hard drive, the way I like to explain it is you've got all the data that's out there all over the hard drive, and then you have a table of contents. And that table of contents is what we call the file system, right? That's where it keeps track of everything that you've got. And where it lays on the drive. So your data on the drive doesn't know that it's in a folder labeled important stuff, right? It's just a bunch of data, and it doesn't know that it's related to other data on the drive. That's what the file system is for. That's what this table of contents is for. And that is what often becomes damaged. And without that, you don't know what you've got out there. So Disk Warrior can rebuild that, but it doesn't try to fix it. And that is it doesn't try to repair it. It tries to rebuild it. And that's an important distinction, because there are other utilities out there. Disk Utility, for example, will try to repair that, but not rebuild it. And then Drive Genius from ProSoft actually will allow you to do either. It will try and repair it or try and rebuild it. So, even though Disk Warrior didn't work, I wouldn't give up hope that you can't repair the file system. It may be irreparable, in which case you've got to. He said he looked into some data recovery companies. He did not mention the one that I would always go with, which is Total Recall or Drive Savers. Either one of those is
Drive Savers. I've seen at nearly every show I've been to, and yeah, they, you know, that they, I think, have a good track record, and they show all the terrible destroyed, you know,
right,
charred machines that they've been able to get data off of. To add to what you said, though, I think it's important. I think he mentioned at one point that one of the errors he got was something about a B tree.
Yeah.
And that's a binary tree. We're not going to get into a computer science course here, but it's a portion of what we're going to call, or I think you call it, the directory, Dave.
The table of contents. The B tree is part of that table of contents. That's
okay.
Right. Yeah.
All right. So you got one part of the drive that's describing what's stored on it, and then you have the data itself.
Right.
And I think the two main strategies, I think, are try to repair the table of contents or the directory or the B tree, or, and then this is the only thing I'd add here, is try to get something. Data rescue, I think, takes another approach. Is I don't think it concerns itself so much with the directory or the table of contents. It scours the drive looking for things that appear to be file-like and tries to recover data in that respect.
Yep. That would have been my final thought. No, it's perfect. Because, again, from ProSoft, data rescue would be the thing to try before sending it off to Drive Savers or Total Recall or one of those places.
I think they have a limited demo that's free that will, I think, I'm not sure if it'll recover, or I think it'll recover maybe one file, but it'll give you confidence that it's doing what it's doing. Now, of course, you're going to lose the names of the file, but it'll identify things that look file-like. And then from that point, you can try to work with them.
Right, right. Yeah, no, it's and you know, the good news, and this is only good news right up until the point where you have to pull out your wallet. The good news is that a place like Drive Savers or Total Recall or any of these others likely will be able to get your data off the drive. I mean, I think they have a 99% plus success rate. They also have a they have a lot of overhead And so it's usually going to cost you, you know, somewhere in the four-figure range to get that data back, and potentially more, potentially less. But don't be surprised if your number is somewhere, you know, close to or north of $1,000 to get that data. They've got to take the drive apart in a you know, very clean environment.
Right. Right.
They actually take the platters out of your hard drive and mount them in another drive that can read them. But in your case, I don't think the hardware is damaged. I think it's the directory structure. And so there might be better ways. In fact, you know, if you send it to Drive Savers, they may not take it apart at all. So, yeah. Hmm. All right. Let's move on. Was there more on that, John? Or are we good?
No, you know, I'm still scratching my head over. I guess all I can say is that any drive can fail at any time.
Well, that's true. Oh, yeah, sure. It could be a bad drive, or it could be a drive gone bad, but chances are it's not. Chances are it's just corrupted.
I'm just still scratching my head over why a drive being read from just suddenly decided to roll over. And I guess
it didn't suddenly decide. He pulled power from it while it was being read.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, that's weird, though. I mean, being written to, that would concern me. Being read, I mean, you're reading. You're not changing anything.
Yeah, but the heads are right there. Like I said, it's not.
It could still traumatize it.
It can still traumatize it. That's right. Yep. Yep. Okay, let's move on to David. David has an interesting question. John, I'm curious to hear your response to this. David writes... I just got a new, what did he get here? A new MacBook Pro 15-inch quad-core i7, and it comes with an SD card slot. What I want to know is, what are some of the wonderful and creative ways one can use this slot other than to store pictures? John? Because I'm curious about this, too. My iMac's got one, and so does, I guess my MacBook Air does not, right? My 11-inch Air doesn't have an SD card. I think that's the one thing it doesn't have in terms of.
You know what?
So go. Tell us. Enlighten us, oh, dear friend.
I got a tale of joy and then a tale of woe.
No. Okay.
The good news is that some smart people, so SD, for the most part, is to access memory cards called Secure Digital or Secure Digital XC, Extended Capacity.
Okay.
And that, for the most part, I think, is what most people use an SD card for. I have the the iFi in my camera, and I think that's what most people use it for, is either file storage or in their digital camera.
Okay.
Now, the thing is some smart people. So here's the good news, and then I'll tell you the bad news. The thing is, some people came out with a really cool build on SD called SDIO. And I even looked this up on Wikipedia, and boy, you know, there, and I've seen some of these, Dave, and you may have actually seen some of these too. So I remember one trade show that I went to. I saw someone with a, I don't know if it was Macworld, but it doesn't matter. And they were using a PDA, not an Apple PDA, but I think a compact or something. And they were scanning people's RFID tags.
Oh, that's
using
cool.
A little SD device, and I'm like, oh, well, that's weird. You're putting that in the SD slot. Isn't that interesting? I only thought that was for memory cards. And they're like, yeah, it's pretty neat. So rather than reading a barcode, which are problematic sometimes, they would hold this RFID reader up to your badge, which had a chip embedded, and it would go bink, and then they knew you attended the session. That was great. And so that's the good news. And there are so many things that are available for SDIO, GPS, modems, barcode readers, radio tuners, RFID readers, like I mentioned, wireless adapters. It's awesome. Here's the bad news. At least according to Apple's support article here about their SD support, article HT3553. Can I use SDIO cards? And sadly, their answer is no.
Very nice.
Doesn't that suck?
There is good news. I want to read their response here.
Well, I got to say, the disappointment to me is that when they took away Express Card and put in SD, I'm like, boy, that's a lame move, because you went from something that had the potential to talk to all sorts of devices to something that's pretty much relegated to reading memory cards. And unfortunately, they I don't know whether it's a driver. Maybe there is a way, if anybody knows. But to me, I think it's more a driver thing than the physical connector, because all these devices use an SD connector. So I don't think it's electrical. I think it's just Apple chose not to provide the drivers to enable these SDIO devices.
Interesting.
I'm sorry. Go.
No. It's too late now. I won't read it. We'll let people read it. You want me to read it? Fine. The answer is no, period. Although SDIO cards are within the width and thickness specifications and should not damage the slot if inserted, they will not be recognized by the computer. So that, I think that speaks to your point. So, yeah.
Well, I think what's happening is at some point it's probably telling whatever it's plugged into, hey, I can do this. And Apple chose to say, yeah, I don't care.
Yeah, that's not the question is moot. All right.
So that's too bad. So not on a Mac, unfortunately.
Not on a Mac. That's right.
Which I hate to say that, but now, so Express Card or Thunderbolt are your options.
Yeah.
SD.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Well, Thunderbolt's a good option if you've got it on your Mac.
Yeah. You know, it's still up and coming in my opinion.
Well, right.
I'm not seeing a lot for it.
Right. Technologically, it's a good option.
Sure.
Use case wise, it's useless at the moment, or mostly useless. That's right. All right, let's dive into follow-ups. We are one question that we're skipping here, but we will post on the site. We talked to listener Joe. He said he was having a problem, and you'll understand why we're going to post this on the site. Listener Joe asked, "How can I every time I quit Terminal on my Mac and relaunch it? Now that I'm in Lion with Mac OS X's restore feature, it puts all my stuff right back there on the screen." And he said, "How do I stop having that happen? I want to start a terminal session and have it come up with a empty terminal window." And Joe, of course, was right. It's Lion's resume feature. And there is a way to turn this off on an application by application basis. But it's a big long terminal command that you're not going to remember if I tell you. So I'm not going to bother going through the pain of explaining this to you, because it's got different caps and non-caps and hyphens and all kinds of crazy things, and spaces scare me. But anyway, the trick is you can, and if you know about this command for other apps, you can issue it for the terminal. The trick is you have to use the terminal to issue the command. So therefore the terminal's preferences do not get updated, immediately. You'll issue the command and then you quit terminal and then you launch terminal and it'll still do the same thing. But now the change is taking effect because you're not inside terminal issuing the command. Once you've done that, then you quit again. And the next time you launch, it comes up blank. So you just need to do a double quit on terminal. And of course, you can't quit something twice without relaunching it in the middle. So, hey, you got to do that, too. So, but we will put that out there as a Mac Geek Gab Answers article. So now, John, we had a couple of questions. You know, we talked about email and it was very popular. I think we struck a chord here, John. Email management.
I'm digging it. I am so happy with my new setup and especially some of the tweaks that I made, which I don't know if we should mention those.
You can mention tweaks, of course.
Well, especially about inboxes. Remember we had an inbox query?
We did. You mean about a non-inbox query, right? The guy that wanted to manage a mailbox?
I'm just going to spit it out here. So the thing was, you chastised me, I believe, because I went down a path that didn't sound reasonable, but then, and I don't have his name in front of me, but one of my Twitter followers got back to me saying, so normally, I think what you brought up, Dave, is that normally only your inbox on an iDevice, only stuff in your inbox is capable of doing a push and letting you know that it's there.
Correct. Yes.
Unless, and this I think is only specific to iDevices and Gmail, is that Gmail can either be set up as an IMAP account, in which case, yes, you are correct. You're entirely correct that you will only get notifications if the inbox is updated. However, you can also connect to your Gmail account as an Exchange account. And the cool part is that Exchange allows you to define multiple mail folders or inboxes for push notification. And I verified this, and you and I went back and forth about this.
Right.
So this answers the question we had before. So the question was, can I get things other than my inbox to do a push notification on my iDevice? And the answer is yes, if you're using Gmail and you set it up as an Exchange account.
Makes sense. Yeah, that's right. And this is true of any Exchange account. So Gmail only on iOS devices is capable of being accessed as an Exchange account. You cannot access it that way from your Mac or your Windows machine, but your iOS device can, and then it comes with these features. That's right.
So that thrilled me because right now, I think as we discussed, I have both my old ISP forwarded to Gmail, but I also have my Mac Observer. And so what I did is I basically selected those two folders because I'd like to know if I get email on either one of those. And now my iDevice will show in the little badge there. It'll show if I get a new email there, it'll update the count on that badge there, which I think was the intent of the original question is I want to know if something's arriving in more than one inbox.
Okay. So now I'm curious because I tried setting up as an Exchange account years and years ago when I first started doing this. And it was a big pain in the neck and I hated it. So and it was like duplicating mail for me on my device and it was crazy. So I went back into the IMAP route and I've been really happy with it. So I have a couple of questions for you. So you are now managing your iOS device is managing your main email, at least, or perhaps your only email as an Exchange account. Is that correct?
Correct. So if I go to settings, mail contacts and calendars.
Yep.
Accounts. It will show Exchange.
Yeah, right. Okay.
For both mail and calendars.
Okay.
And then if I go to the configuration screen, so then if I dig one deeper, it'll then say mail folders to push. And that's where you can select one or more mail folders on the Gmail account in which you will get a push notification.
Okay. So stay there because I'm curious about this. So what are the folders in your list that you have available to push? You've got
Well, here's the nastiness.
Down the list. Yeah. Okay.
Here's the bad news is that whereas if you set it up as IMAP, you can hide folders. Here it shows all of them.
Okay. So
even inbox, sent items, trash. I got one for my Mac world, Gmail, and under that, all mail, spam, starred, Apple Mail to do, deleted messages, my old ISP. Mac Observer.
Okay, so that's enough. That's enough. So the all mail folder is still being pushed to your device, which is something that I think is really stupid. It's everything.
Well, the thing is, I understand that it's displaying it in the configuration, but I don't see it in my list of inboxes.
No, it's not an inbox, but the problem with that.
I think I know what you're saying. Is that it's showing. Because I'm not using IMAP, it's showing me all the folders that are defined in my Gmail account. Which
right, but even if you're using IMAP, you want to turn that all mail folder off, which you can do, like you said, for IMAP. You cannot do for Exchange. The problem with the all mail folder is it's the roots of this problem are in the way Gmail manages mail. There are no such thing as folders at Gmail. Everything is a label. And when you talk about things in terms of labels, well, then things can have multiple labels and that's OK. It's still just one message. But what Gmail has done for their Exchange implementation and for their IMAP implementation is they have said labels equal folders. And this is where it gets crazy because you can have things with multiple labels and one message. And the all mailbox duplicates everything. Everything in your inbox is also in all mail. Everything in your archive box is also in all mail. Everything in your you had a Macworld box is also in all mail. That's fine at gmail.com. It's actually fine on your iOS device because unless you go to that all mail folder, it will not load the contents of it. Where it is a problem is on your Mac. And if you're connecting to Gmail on your Mac, obviously you can't do Exchange. You have to do IMAP.
Right.
But make sure you go into Gmail on the web first and disable that all mail folder from showing up in IMAP. Otherwise, anytime you search for mail or anything, you're going to have at least potentially more than two copies of every message. It's a big pain in the neck. So
that's a good point. Yeah. It's a good point. So whereas the Exchange thing makes sense on an iDevice? Yeah, no, you bring up a very good point that. Because actually I do the same thing. I access it as IMAP on my Mac, but as Exchange on my iDevice because I wanted to get those multiple push notifications from different folders or, as you point out, labels.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that out. How has it been for battery life for you?
Okay.
Yes. Okay. All right. So you didn't notice any big difference going from IMAP to the Gmail Exchange thing, huh?
Not really, though. I've been I've been charging my battery as of late because I've been doing the Waze thing.
That'll burn your battery anyway. Yeah, right.
Well, not if I have it in my my Magellan Pro car kit that has the charger in it.
Right.
But it's really kind of neat. Now, Waze is we mentioned this, but I'm digging it. So pretty much anytime I get in the car, if I have a moment, I'll hook it up. But it's so neat that it's a crowdsourced traffic alerting system.
Yeah, that's cool.
Well, the fun part is, you know, so say you're driving by the highway and you see a law enforcement official.
Yes.
Well, you can, not saying you should be fiddling with your iDevice, but you can very quickly. Well, no, the interface makes it good. Or if you're stopped in traffic. So you know, if you do it safely, you hit a button, say report police. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Like the other day, I was driving along and there was something fell off some guy's truck. So, you know, I was driving along and then, you know, looked around and basically hit one button, obstruction, in-road, done.
Yeah,
it was really quick.
That's good.
It's a neat little app.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
All right. Let's move on to tips. I think we've covered all the mail stuff. We had a couple of questions about it, but I think we've sort of gone through most of this here. So that's good. So moving on to James actually has kind of a tip and an answer. Back in show 370, we talked about Michael Johnston having an issue of iTunes automatically moving music off of his Drobo and onto the root level of his hard drive. And James says, regarding that problem, in my case, it was moving music and music video files out of a library located on an external drive. So very similar setup to what Michael had. He says, although I didn't troubleshoot why this was occurring, I noticed that the artists of the files being moved all had special characters in their names. And he cites Pink as an example with P exclamation point NK. He says, my solution was to replace the special characters in the artist name with standard characters. After doing this, I haven't had any issues. So that's very interesting that iTunes on an external drive maybe it has some more to do with OS X's, you know, mapping of the file system than anything else. But yeah, having an exclamation point in there, that's interesting. So thank you for sharing that, James. That's interesting advice and good troubleshooting in a general sense. I've seen issues where people that have funny names in their hard drive name or funny characters in their hard drive have all kinds of weird problems. And I actually had a friend, he asked me to look at his computer. And of course, I didn't look at the hard drive name. It's not something I ever think about. And we couldn't think of it. And he brought it to the Genius Bar. And instantly this girl at the Genius Bar said, oh, here's your problem. Your hard drive's got this funny name. And it was like his cat had walked on his keyboard and renamed his hard drive. So it had all these funny characters, you know, and as soon as he changed it, all his problems went away. So that's good. Watch out for funny characters.
Watch out for cats.
John, you have you had an interesting little story to tell. So
I can condense this. So my printer adventure.
Yeah. This is good. Yeah. Go.
All right. So, a while ago, I got my sister and I. Wait,
remember
me and my sister,
you're John Braun.
Correct.
Okay,
I remember that
podcast.
Yes, okay. I do. But I'm giving you the backstory. You don't care about the backstory. Okay,
no.
You want me to just drill down? I'm going to drill down. Okay, I came across some ink cartridges, HP ink cartridges.
Okay.
But they were very similar to the ones that are in my current printer. So I have a HP B8550. It's a really nice inkjet printer. And why I like it is because it can print up to 13x19. And I like to print my own photos and frame them and have them in the house for people to marvel at. So I came across a supply of these cartridges that looked identical, but they had a different model number. So my printer takes 564 cartridges. These were 920s, and I looked at them and I'm like, they're the same. So I took one of these that I came across and pulled one out of my printer, put in this 920. It fit perfectly and it looked identical, same form factor. So I'm like, oh, wow, I just came across some free ink. Then I fired up my printer and it said, oh, I'm sorry, this is the wrong model ink cartridge for this printer. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You guys are evil.
Really?
Now, Yes. Now, looking at these again, Dave, if you looked at these two ink cartridges, they are identical. It's CYMK. It's you know, different. Everything is the same. The color, the form factor. It's just it's a different model number. So I'm like, OK, I'm going to beat you guys. So how can the printer possibly know that it's a different model number? Is it reading the cartridge? Well, yes, it is. And how is it doing this, you may ask? Well, there's a little chip on the ink cartridge.
Right.
Now, one may think, gee, you know what? You know, I wonder what would happen if I took the chip on one of the ink cartridges that works. Maybe pry it off carefully, maybe being careful because it is a little mini circuit board. And then putting it on the other cartridge and see what happens. And you know what happened?
What?
It works just great.
Dude, that's awesome. Oh, yeah. Man, now the thing you did it. You beat the system.
There was some battle damage here, is that one of the ones that I experimented with, I did flex the circuit board too much and broke one of the traces. So you got to be careful if you're going to pry this chip off of certain ink cartridges, not to use too much force because it's somewhat fragile. But then the other thing that I started freaking out about was, so one of the cartridges that I had that, so one of them I broke the chip and I had none left. So then I went to my local office supply store and I had some credits because I bring them my empty cartridges and I got some compatible ones that they had.
Okay.
And I'm like, oh, cool. Now, the only thing is that the printer will whine about them maybe being empty, because the thing is they start the counter when they're new and then it counts down and sometimes it'll keep annoying you with these messages. So I got one of the compatible ones and I put it in and it's like, oh, I don't recognize this cartridge. Something's wrong with it. It's broken. And I'm like, oh man, I totally destroyed my printer. Oh, I shouldn't have done this. No. What happened is apparently some of these remanufactured cartridges are not of the highest quality.
They're junk is what they are.
But no, what happened is, this. I've never had a leaking problem, but basically, so I took one of the thing is, I got two of them. So I got two of the magenta ones. The thing is, when I put in, the printer said, I don't see an ink cartridge in this slot. Something's very wrong here. And that was the same experience I had when I broke the trace on the chip on the one that I experimented with. And I'm like, oh, well, you know what? Let me take the other one. And I put it in and it said, oh, everything's cool. Though you may be low on ink on this one. Cool. What happened is I had purchased one that was defective. I went to the store, which is right down the street from me, and my printer says this is broken. They're like, oh, I'm sorry, sir. And they're like, almost. Well, the thing is, they know that these are probably ones like the ones I bring in that are of questionable quality, and they refill them with ink and they hope they work. And if they don't, they're more than happy to exchange them. So I got to shake my fist a bit at HP because again, these are identical. It's CYMK.
CYMK. But who's counting? That's just me being anal retentive. That's okay.
Yeah. But the thing is, it's the same ink technology, same form factor. Why do you have two different model numbers for what, as far as, and looking at the print quality, I see no difference in the pigment or anything. They're just doing it to make dough.
Yeah. Oh yeah, of course they are.
But why create something in the same form factor with different model numbers? So one works in one. Yeah, but to me, that's just that's creating unnecessary complexity. Is that both? And the printer is one that we bought for my mom. The thing is, it takes the same form factor ink cartridge. Why wouldn't you want to simplify your manufacturing operation? Or do they want it so that I can't share ink cartridges? I guess they do.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
Are you in it? We're running. Do you have any inkjet printers, Dave?
Yeah, I've got one.
Do you buy the new ones? Do you buy the remanufactured? Do you refill them? I mean,
I don't buy the remanufactured stuff, which is a lesson. I mean, you heard me ranting about it, but it's a lesson I learned from.
You had some leak?
I've had really bad laser printed toner cartridges.
Talking ink.
No, I know, but I've stayed away from the remanufactured anything when it comes to a printer, simply because of that. I've seen clients that have had big problems with them. So, and like you said, you know, about 30% of them don't work. And it's a big problem. But what I do, I don't buy, direct from the manufacturer's website. I'll hunt around on Amazon or Inkjets for Less or, two for one Inkjet, that kind of, I'll find them somewhere. But you're totally getting screwed. I mean, this printer that I have at the house, I bought for $20 a year ago. It's got a scanner. It's an HP. Oh, I don't remember what it is. It's an HP something or other. and it's got a scanner in it and a printer, and it, you know, it looks really good. And it cost me $20 like last November when I was hunting for, it's a DeskJet 1040 J410 or 1050 mm-hmm. rather. But the first time I had to buy ink for it was like $30. So it's like, wow, I should have bought two printers and just thrown the other printer away and taken the ink cartridges out of the box. It was crazy. That's crazy. I should have just filled up my car with printers.
Although they do sell you, I don't know if you know, when you get a new printer, they only give you like demo cartridges.
Yeah,
they're starter. Yeah, I saw that too.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, they last special. 2 days.
Now the other thing I've seen,
only 40 years old, right. And they'll last you 2 days at best.
Now the other thing that I've seen, and I may want to invest in this, though so far I've been happy with the remanufactured or refilled, because I think mostly what they do is they drill a hole in these and they put in equivalent.
You can do that yourself too if you're really into it.
But then I've seen these other systems that I don't print that much to justify this, but I've seen these continuous feed systems where you basically replace the ink cartridges with this ink pump system.
Right.
But I was just so happy that I stuck it to the man and was able to pry the chip off. And as far as the printer was concerned, because I saw in each of the ink cartridge spaces was a four conductor thing that read the chip, and that's how good. It knew, oh, it's not a 920. This is a cartridge that I'm going to refuse to use, even though technically I can. And I'm like, oh yeah.
All right. Back in show 361, we talked about an app that we found that would rotate, that would allow you to rotate the screen of your MacBook Air, really any Mac, so that you could use it in like more of a book reading, you know, landscape format. Well, Will sent in this little note and he said, you can rotate the screen on any Mac by going into System Preferences, then hold down Alt or Option and Command simultaneously, two buttons down, while you click on the displays icon. And when you do that, a new option shows up called rotation, and you can set it away from standard to any one of the other three edges of the screen. So there you go. And he says this works in both Snow Leopard and in Lion. And it should work on any monitor that is internal to your Mac and possibly even some of those that are external. Yep.
Pete, did it work on your Air, or were you, I thought you were having.
Oh yeah, no, I finally got it. I just,
It is a little tricky. You've got to launch System Preferences, then hold down Command and Option, then click on Displays and it will show up. Yeah.
Okay. Cause I thought it was dependent on either the video driver or the chipset, or I guess not.
No.
It seems to be universal for Macs, but I don't know what. For the first time I opened System and Preferences, it didn't come up right, but the second time it came right up.
Now you got to get used to the orientation shift.
And then getting your mouse to
and
work
then if you, or touchpad. Yeah. Unless you're really good in spatial.
You have to confirm it, right?
Because, yes. Or it goes back to normal, because I was not fast enough to say, yeah, go back on.
But then, as you saw, I mean,
I like to think I'm pretty spatially competent, you know, being a pilot and all.
But what was up was left and right, right?
Yeah.
I mean, no.
Hey, Pete does pretty well here. We've got him talking, and he's hearing himself just like I hear myself on about a 30 millisecond, maybe 40 millisecond delay. And
it's a good thing I'm slow. Is that what you're saying?
You've never picked up on it, or you've never. Okay, so that was really funny. Here I was talking about the delay because of the way we have the podcast thing set up. And it's like, man, these gremlins and these computers, they know how to get me.
Exactly the right time.
It was at exactly that point in time that the whole system started echoing a loop on me. We lost John on Skype. All Pete and I could hear in our ears was the last thing I said for about, you know, a quarter second, just echoing and echoing. John, you are back? Yes.
I'm back.
Okay, good.
Well, I never went away.
Yes, right. But
as far as the listeners are concerned.
That's right. Well, yeah, this was sort of interesting. All right. We have one last comment to play, which I hope will make it. And then we'll fade on out into the sunset here together. So I will cue up this comment momentarily from David.
Hello, John and Dave. This is David, amateur radio call sign AA6RV, based in Southern California. On MacGeekGab 370, you mentioned you didn't become amateur radio operators, partially based on the fact that you love the internet. Well, I'm here to tell you that the amateur radio community is well and alive with both radio and the internet. Back in 2001, the Japanese Amateur Radio League defined an open specification called D-STAR, which stands for Digital Smart Technology for Amateur Radio, that has been very successful in evolving and growing to over 20,000 users worldwide. D-STAR basically transmits both voice and data simultaneously in a digitally encapsulated message over the airwaves through radio transmission or via network technology to include the internet, thereby allowing long-distance communications between ham radio operators via the internet and the amateur radio. You guys got me into the Mac, which I am internally grateful, and finally see the errors to the Microsoft way. After all, it wasn't Moses who finally got the tablets correct. It was Steve Jobs. But I have a challenge for you two. If you guys become ham radio operators and make contact with me via D-STAR with your own license call sign, which basically means you have to get your ham radio license, in this case, I hope you do finally get caught. I will become a premier member myself. I've always supported you guys by purchasing stuff from your sponsors, and I got to be honest with you, nothing beats those audio engineer speakers. Guys, happy holidays, and this is where you could cut me off.
Awesome. Well, I'm not sure if I'll ever wind up with the time to get my ham license, but only because I've got other things on the old priority.
Well, you know,
but I might. It's possible.
Well, apparently you can get a no code license, right? No.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the thing that tripped.
That's not, I mean, Morse code's not that hard. That's not the issue. Not for me.
Yeah, well, neither is, you know, breaking out the buggy whip if you want your transport to move faster. Come on.
So he talked about the premium version of Mac Geek Gab, John. Premium allows you, beloved listener, to get an extra, well, yeah, you can buy it too, an extra 2 episodes per month. Plus access to all the archives, plus that warm, fuzzy feeling that only you can get only by supporting your two favorite geeks. And you can do that at MacGeekGab.com, and it's only $25 for 6 months. Again, 2 extra episodes every month, all the archives, everything. $25 every 6 months. So we'd certainly appreciate having
what a deal.
You join us.
You know, you might as well start the new year off right. And
that's right.
Just go and buy one.
In fact, go subscribe right now. We're going to record a premium show on Thursday, and you'll get that. You'll get all the ones that we've already recorded, of course. But then you'll get the new one coming up this Thursday. And then after Thursday, the schedule's going to be a little bit funky next week, only because I'm at CES. But we are going to try and schedule a recording while I'm out there because we've done well with that with previous
trips. I'll have to help you next year.
You can go instead of me next year. That sounds great. Listen, right. Las Vegas during crazy trade show like CES, it's like totally overloaded, bursting at the seams. You can't get anywhere.
I guess I could use
pain
that.
In the neck. It's a big pain in the neck. But anyway, right. I'll be out there. All right. But if you want to contact us otherwise, you can email feedback@macgeekgab.com.
And I'm almost positive I heard you right, Dave, in that you said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
That's right. So feedback@macgeekgab.com. You send your emails. You send your text-based emails. You can send voice. You can use the voice recorder on your iPhone or iPod to create a memo and then send that via email. You can send screenshots. You can send videos.
You can send schematics for a 3D model of what you think your problem. No.
You sure you could? Hey, we take all kinds. But if you want to call us, you can call 206-666-GEEK, which John is
4335. But there are so many ways to reach us, Dave. It's just ridiculous. Another way is this this crazy Facebook thing that all the kids seem to be into. Facebook.com/, you guessed it, Mac Geek Gab. And you can join our Facebook community.
Yeah, like us over there even. Facebook.com/MacGeekGab. You can also find us Twitter.com/MacGeekGab for the show. And individually, we're all on Twitter. Him as John F. Braun. Him as Pilot Pete. Me as Dave Hamilton. And you can visit all the show notes there over at MacGeekGab.com. We would love to thank Michael Johnston for converting this show and most of the other shows into AAC. I think the last one didn't get converted. That was my fault. CashFly provides the bandwidth. CashFly.com. A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software, Text Expander from SmileSoftware.com, and Gazelle.com for all your old news electronics in the Factory Media Podcast Marketplace. Folks, have a happy new year. Come join us on Premium. We'll see you on Thursday. And until then, don't get caught.